I'm talking now to Mr. Satchell of Charmouth, who's going to tell me all about his First World War experiences.
It's good.
The outbreak, just after the outbreak of war in 1914, I became a private soldier in the Honourable Artillery Company. And early in December that year, my headmaster of Rugby discovered this, and apparently, unknown to me, arranged for me to be commissioned into the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, which was my home regiment. I lived then in Rugby. And one morning, the corporal came to me, he said, "Satchel, the sergeant wants to see you." And I saw the sergeant, he said, "The sergeant major wants to see you." And I thought, "Well, what the devil have I been up to?" When I got to the sergeant major, he said, "3 o'clock this morning. I was in the order room with my best salute." Colonel said, "Hello, another one of them." I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, "I've just got instructions." He said, "You've been commissioned to the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. Pack your bags and go." Off I went. And I reported to Bugbrook, B-U-G-B-R-O-O-K, Barracks in Warwickshire. This was entirely unknown to my parents. Didn't have time to get in touch with them. But I found I'd been commissioned as a second lieutenant and posted down to Parkhurst Barracks in the Isle of Wight. Well, at 6 o'clock in the morning on the 8th of December, I fell in, and we were chased around the square by the sergeant major, because a young officer was treated as a private soldier on parade for the first 3 months of his career. He went into the officer's mess to feed, but he took no command at all. And we were standing at ease, and there's a chap on my right, this was on the 8th of December, I said, "When did you join the regiment?" He said, "This morning." I said, "Well, so did I." And I said, "Well, what's your name?" He said, "My name is Slim." And he, of course, became the famous Field Marshal Slim. And that's how he started, as an ordinary, temporary gentleman, as they called us young officers. Anyway, then they shunted us over to Bovington Camp. We were the first troops in Bovington Camp. And we were on parade one day when a Colonel Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, from Aldershot Gymnastic Staff, came to inspect us on parade. Well, I had competed in the 1913 public schools gymnastic competitions at Aldershot. And for some reason I did rather well. But he pointed out, he said, "Your name's Satchel." I said, "Yes." He said, "I judged your gymnastics at Aldershot last summer." I said, "That's correct, sir." I heard no more about it until next day. Colonel sent for him. He said, "Satchel, you're posted to the Army Gymnastic Staff." I said, "Well, that's a nice thing. I don't want to go to the Army Gymnastic Staff. You've got to well use your toe." So off I went to Aldershot. And I was eventually sent back down to Bovington Camp in charge of physical training and bayonet fighting for the 55th Brigade, which of course covered Bovington, Blandford and a few other places. And there I got stuck. All my pals were going off, Slim amongst them. He was wounded in Gallipoli. I saw Slim off, and I got fed up with this, and I said, "I want to get out of this lot." And he said, "You can't." When one day, this went on until the middle of 1916, when one day, due to the difficulty, the short, terrible shortage of pilots in the Royal Flying Corps, a order from the War Office came out, any officer wishing to join the Royal Flying Corps, his application must be forwarded. It cannot be held up by his commanding officer. So in my went, the mine went, and within a week I was in the Royal Flying Corps. Better switch off for a minute. And then I was sent to Reading, where we did an awful lot of preliminary work for 3 months training at Reading on all the engines and, you know, how aeroplanes flew and I don't know what. And from there I was sent to Thetford in Norfolk, where I learnt to fly on Morris Farman Shorthorns. That's a pusher. And then from said, incidentally, Thetford was alongside the prohibited area where they were testing out our first tanks. This was in end of 1916. And flying over that area was prohibited. But of course yours truly must go and have a look. And they got anti-aircraft shells bursting all around me. Only to frighten me. Yeah. I was then sent on to Sedgeford, a bit further north, where I learnt to fly Henry Farman's. That was a wonderful machine. A single-seater. Again a pusher, with a gnome engine, which of course ran for about 1 hour before a valve blew in the piston head and you had to come down. So you carried a kit of tools, took the cylinder head off and put a new valve in, then got the local farmer to start you up, and off you went again. Anyway, then I then put on to FE2Bs. Now an FE2B is a pusher. It had the power engine. I think it was 120 horsepower Beardmore engine. Well, that, I played about on those, chiefly diving, running along the cliffs at Hunstanton, waving to the girls on a Sunday afternoon. Unfortunately, one Sunday the Navy had put a wireless aerial up with a post on the cliff and three posts on the sand. I didn't know this and went slap through the lot of it. I knew immediately because there were wires all over the place, and I arrived back at the aerodrome to find the colonel waiting for me. He said, "Satchel, you've been flying over the pier at Hunstanton." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You pulled down the naval wireless there." I said, "Yes, you'll find most of it hanging onto the tail." Well, he said, "You're under close arrest." So I was put under close arrest with two officers in my room. And next morning, about 6 o'clock, there was a tap on the door. In came in the colonel. He said, "Satchel, I've got to send a pilot to France right away. Now, if I send you, you won't be here when your marshal comes off, will you?" So I packed my bags and I was off to France. Couldn't even go home. I had to phone my parents to tell them I was going. And that's the way I got out of that one. And then I reported to 20 Squadron.
Tell me, Mr. Satchel, something about what it felt like when you first got airborne. This was a completely new experience, even to your instructors, I imagine. So, can you tell me something about the training? Were you frightened? You must have had some hairy
moments.
Oh, no,
they were very slow machines, you know. I think their landing speed, the Morris Farman Shorthorn, I think its landing speed was not more than 40 miles an hour. And if he got good shock absorbers, so he hit the ground a bit hard, it didn't matter. It's solely a matter of judgment of height, of course.
Now, With the chance of your engine failing so easily and often, did this not worry you? Or?
No, you got used to keeping an eye open for all the nice green fields as you went along, and so you could get back into them.
Did you have any set pattern for doing a forced landing?
Well, you always had to know which way the wind was blowing. You chose the best looking field and got over the hedge in the right direction of the wind. Because you came to rest, you know, in 50 yards or something like that in those machines. They weren't dangerous in any way at all.
Did they have a fairly long glide? Could you cover a fair distance if your engine cuts, say, at 1,000 feet?
Yes, they could. You know, quite a long glide. I suppose their top speed was about 65 miles an hour, and their landing speed was between 35 and 40.
And what was your takeoff speed and distance?
Oh, takeoff in 100 yards easily.
Yeah.
Yeah, easily.
And climbing, how long would it take?
Well, it took a hell of a time to get up there. You'll find most, you don't go above 1,000 feet when you're learning to fly.
Now, you wouldn't have had parachutes then, would you?
Oh, no. Never had parachutes, and they didn't have parachutes in the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Air Force, which followed it after the 1st of April 1918. Although the Germans all had parachutes, but we wouldn't. Trenchard said he would not allow us to have parachutes, otherwise we'd jump out and let the machines crash. He wouldn't agree to us having parachutes.
What did it feel like when you first got on the squadron? Obviously you were a relative new boy.
Well, of course, you couldn't have got amongst the kinder crowd of fellows in your life. They're wonderful chaps. One thing they looked after was the new one. Trouble was, arriving in France in February of the year 1917, it was a very cold winter with snow on the ground. And the difficulty was, we were water-cooled engines then, because the FE2D had Rolls-Royce engines. I mentioned the FE2B, that had the Beardmore with it, and that was the engine. I was never let down by a Rolls-Royce engine the whole time I was flying. And, well, because I had the pieces knocked off, that wasn't the maker's fault. But the trouble was getting started in the morning. And we had no... we had a big bonfire, took old petrol cans and boiled water, and the mechanics poured this boiling water into your cooling system, and then they had three shots at starting you by pulling the propeller while you twisted a starting magneto. It wasn't a self-start, so it didn't power the engine, but it did provide us power. And if it didn't start after three shots, they let all the water out, and then they started again and filled you up with more boiling water. So if you were due to go off at, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, you had to start work getting the engines going about 6 o'clock, because you'd get, say, 10 of you going off, you'd get three or four started and another one wouldn't start. So they used to keep them ticking over and they used to refill us with petrol while the engines were running. Eventually we'd get off after about a couple of hours.
Now, when you went to that squadron as a new boy, obviously because of the weather, as you've just said, it took a while before you really got any flying practice in. How were you treated, though? I mean, were you taken up by another machine leading you in formation to show you where you're situated?
Yes,
and,
yes. Well, you became the
ground features.
You became a member of the flight. We always flew in fours. There's a pushy. See? That was the leader. And he had a couple of streamers. Now, that probably put you there as a newcomer, because this chap would watch your tail, you see. And then you gradually progressed round until you became the leader. That was after quite a long time.
What sort of instruments did you have? Presumably you had a magnetic compass, did you?
Yes.
Airspeed indicator?
Airspeed indicator and rev counter.
No altimeter? Or?
Oh, yes, you had an altimeter. That's when you were flying a Packer machine, but I should have mentioned that when I arrived at the Sedgford, which was the last flying school before I went overseas, I found no instruments whatsoever in the planes at all. They took them all out. You've got to fly by instinct.
Not even an airspeed indicator?
No, not an airspeed indicator. It was all an altimeter. Took the lot out. And of course, being rotary engines, you could tell whether they're running well or not by the noise, you see. They were all gnome engines. That's with learning to fly. But overseas, you had the full complement of instruments.
Now, when you weren't flying, what did you do in the mess? Did you have jolly good parties, or...?
Oh, yes. Yes. Look at this. Oh, yes, yes. We had quite a lot of gunpowder. The squadron ended up on Bristol fighters, and I flew Bristol fighters for a few hours only, because I was sent home before they got really on. The second squadron in France to be fly with Bristol fighters, so I loved that. That was a Rolls-Royce Falcon engine. The FE-2Ds was a Rolls-Royce Eagle engine. And the most powerful one we had was 375 horsepower.
Now, when you were in combat, you obviously had to throw your machines about. In other words, you had to do aerobatics. So yes. Did you learn your own aerobatics, or were you taught aerobatics?
Not before I went to France. I was taught aerobatics after I came back at the School of Special Flying at Gosport. But with an FE-2D, you couldn't loop it. It was too heavy. But what we could do was to stand on our tail, and that used to frighten the Hun, you see. He would dive on you, and you would sideslip. A very small sideslip. And of course that meant his bullets missed you. And then when he went up, arm ahead, to loop over you again and do it, you went up on your right up like that and just pumped the bullets into him.
And then you sort of followed on from that with a stall turn.
You just stall turn, you just fell out, you see, fell out of the turn.
Now, you could actually see the Hun's bullets, they were tracers, presumably.
Yes, they were like us, they had about 1 in 5 tracer. Yes.
How did you aim? Did you allow for any sort of deflection, or was it very much a hit or miss?
Well, on the FE-2D, we had...
Now, you know, you're looking back in retrospect now. Did you at the time ever feel fear at all? Were you ever frightened?
You never get frightened when you're scrapping. Strange, isn't it? You sometimes begin to get a wonder when you get back and think, well, I'm very lucky. No, you've got too much to think about.
Did you ever feel that your nerves were getting ragged?
No. Never. Mind you, we didn't do an awful lot of flying. If we did, as you see from there, if we did 3 hours a day, that was a lot. Sometimes we did two big shows a day, but that was unusual. I'm talking 1917. It got worse afterwards.
Now, not having any parachutes, were you frightened of being shot down in flames from which you couldn't escape?
Well, you never thought about it.
Didn't.
Yeah. You occasionally saw a whole chap shot down in flames and he couldn't do a thing about it. Terrible sight.
Now, you must have had a lot of good friends on
yes.
the squadron. Did it upset you when they didn't come back
oh,
or
yes,
you saw
yes.
them shot down?
The Germans were extremely good. I should say that only 25% of people shot down were killed. They got some engine shot up or something like that and they had to land. But we used to say that within 6 hours of that happening we'd know the facts. And the Germans would pop over and drop a message bag. Very often with the report of what had happened in the man's own handwriting. And we did the same in reverse. That's why I say it was a gentleman's war in the air. Quite different to the last war. Quite different.
So, in a way, of course, you were looking at the ground from a great height, obviously. You didn't have the same discomfort and the terrible conditions that the chaps in the trenches had.
Oh.
It was a different war for you.
Gosh, that was a terrible war in the trenches. Before I came home, of course, the Battle of Passchendaele had started, which was just mud. I'd never seen anything like it from the air, the tragedy around me in Passchendaele. Oh,
when you came home on leave, you were telling me you had several bouts of leave. Being a pilot with the old RFC wings, did you find that all the females flocked towards you, the same as they did in the last war? You know, there's a certain amount of glamour attached to being a pilot.
All looked at you, but of course I was I wasn't engaged to be married then, but I had my girlfriend, so they didn't worry me very much, these others.
But in a way, you were on a higher romantic level than shall we say, the poor old Tommy that came home.
I don't know.
There always seemed to be a lot of glamour attached to the RFC. What was your most exciting moment, or fearful moment, in flying-wise? You must have had, you know, pretty...
Well, I think probably being... having my propeller shot to pieces and the engine tipping over in its bearers and having to come down, I was right the far side of the line when I got over the German lines and crashed in a shell hole about 1,000 yards behind our front line. When I got down there, of course, I pancaked it, slap into a shell hole, so nothing happened to us. My observer jumped one way and I jumped the other because within less than a minute the Germans had ranged their guns on this plane and I was in a communication trench. I'd lost him, he was in a communication trench running parallel. So I wandered down this trench and I heard voices. I didn't know whether I was, which side of the lines I was. So I heard voices down in the dugout and I crept gingerly down. Couldn't make out what was happening. And all of a sudden it dawned on me they were Scotchmen. I couldn't understand them. So I was all right. And I then went down to a lane at the end of the trenches and I was walking. Oh, the Scotchman had told me where the first aid dressing post was, you see, and directed me to it. So I went down this lane, having gone down this trench. Just as I was walking down there, a blinking battery of 6-inch guns opened straight over my head and knocked me flat on the ground. These gunners were having a... did it on purpose, you see. And having woken up and told them what I thought about them, I found this one AD, this first aid post, and there was my observer already there having a cup of tea. For which I managed to get a message back to the squadron. And they sent out a tender.
Obviously, you and your observer must have been very close, friendly,
you had to be.
You did lose one chap, didn't you?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Yes, that was a young Canadian, Wilkinson, who was shot in the back of the head while we were taking oblique photographs from the wrong side of the line. In other words, we were taking them from the German side of the line instead of our side of the line. Somebody got a good idea. It was the only time it was ever done. And we got about half the plates taken when he just collapsed. And I managed to get to Bailleul Aerodrome and signaled that, because that was the nearest aerodrome to a hospital. And they rushed out, and we got him in the hospital. And he only lived for about 3 days.
Were you very upset about
that? Oh, yeah.
How did you go about picking your next observer? Did you sort of just become friends, anyone that was available, or did
No. Wilkinson wasn't my real observer, but he was a great photographer observer, and he was flying with me that day. My old other observer, who was a Canadian also, it was most amusing how I found him. Dutchman named Malcolm Todd. And I flew with him for a while till I went on leave. We both went on leave together, they sent partners earlier, and he was taken ill. That was quite early on in my flying in France. So I came back to the aerodrome, not knowing he was ill, when I saw another Scotsman in kilts walking towards me. He said, "Your name's Satchel, isn't it?" I said, "Yes." Well, he said, "Do you know Todd's not coming back?" I said, "No, he's ill." He said, "Can I be your observer?" So I said, "Well, what the blazes do you know about observing?" He said, "Nothing, I've never been in an aeroplane." So I said, "Come on then, we'll get a plane out." And got him in it, and I took him up, threw him all over the sky, and he was smiling when he came down, so I said, "You'll do for me." Jenks, his name was. In fact, I've only written a letter last week to his widow in Montreal. But he was mainly my observer. Depended to some extent on what you're doing, for some observers are specialists at certain things. For ordinary scrapping, Jenks, and he's a marvellous. He might have just been out in the garden shooting at rabbits, as you were concerned. He never got excited. I always remember the last flight we had together. We had landed. He went home too. They sent him home the same time as they sent me home. And I'd always seen a box put onto the plane, into his seat, and I didn't inquire what this breaking box was. I said to him, they lowered it down to him. He lowered it down to the mechanic when we came in on our last flight. Said, "What's in that box, Archie?" "Oh," he said, "that's a complete medical kit, in case anything happened to you." He was a medical student at Montreal University. Marvellous fellow.
Didn't any of the observers ever remuster to pilot?
Oh, yes. This chap, This chap was a co-flight commander with me. Inky Stevens, he's still alive. He's now 84. He was an observer before being a pilot. He started flying about beginning of 1915 as an observer. And he and I were flight commanders at the same time.